Yeah, this is Lincoln Bergman. I'm with Stu Albert and Abby Hoffman. And who are you?
Karen Michelson.
Karen Michelson. Abby Hoffman, as you probably know, is one of the defendants in the trial of seven members of the conspiracy in Chicago.
Nine, counting the two lawyers.
Well, seven members. There's a lot more members of the conspiracy. And he just came out here, and the defense has just started in the case. I thought, to begin, maybe we'd talk a little bit about how you see what the prosecution has done so far.
Yeah, we've heard
a little bit about it and so on. What they've done and what their tactics have been and how effective it was.
Well, they've presented what's called a classical prosecution against conspiracy, which means to present no evidence. It's kind of a weird type of conspiracy. They don't have to prove that we met. They don't have to actually prove that a riot actually took place, or if they do, they don't have to make a distinction whether it was a people's riot or a police riot. According to this law, they only have to prove that we had a certain state of mind when we crossed state lines. Quite frankly, I must say that if I was sitting on the jury, I would be unable to reach a verdict about our innocence or guilt. Being a defendant, I can't. I mean, I don't know what my state of mind is. Especially when I went from Pennsylvania, you know, into Indiana and then from there.
Remember, Abby, that, like, during the Chicago thing, the one thing was our state of mind kept changing.
Oh, absolutely.
Remember?
Yeah. Well, it depended on Lyndon Johnson and what he was going to do that day and what Sirhan was going to do that morning.
And then, like, when they talk about conspiracy, like all the hassles that we had in Chicago, it was disagreements and this and this and this and this. I mean, it was a joke to call it a conspiracy.
We didn't
even have a decent collective, much less a conspiracy.
When we were arraigned on April 8th, the eight of us had to be introduced to each other. Some of us had known each other, and Jerry and I knew each other pretty well. Yeah. And we'd met Tom, and we knew Rennie, and we knew Dave because he was from New York. But I had never met Bobby Seale. In fact, Bobby Seale being in the case was the biggest shock to all of us. The evidence against Bobby Seale throughout the 10.5 weeks consisted of one statement, kill the pigs, in a 15-minute speech in Lincoln Park, which turned out to not be kill the pigs, but barbecue some pork, which translated means kill the pigs, and an airplane ticket that he bought here at San Francisco Airport. And it's considerably more evidence than against some of the others, but...
We talk a little bit about how it hit the other defendants when all that went down against Seale happened in the courtroom.
Well, let me get a bit into their case.
I started to tell what it was.
They had 57 witnesses. They had 27 Chicago police officers. They had about 17 FBI agents, about two or three Secret Service men, one guy from Army Intelligence and a guy from Navy Intelligence. Still can't figure out whether he found our yellow submarine fleet in Lake Michigan or not, but he was there. And then they had a series of FBI undercover agents and informers, and then they had newsmen that fell into two categories. Newsmen that were dragged there with tapes like the one that we're making for this show and forced to play them in the trial. Newsmen who doubled as FBI informers. There were three of them. It was straight out of the 1950s. They had code names, Louis Salzberg, a photographer in New York, code name Winston. Even my wife didn't know I was a double agent. You know?
Or a cigarette.
Why did you decide to do it? Well, I was at a rally 6 years ago, and I saw the hammer and sickle on a red flag, and it was twice the size of the American flag, and the American flag was touching the ground, and I then and there decided to dedicate myself to God and country.
I was a communist for the FBI.
There were no surprises, and I mean, Stu hasn't, like, turned up, you know, as one of the government witnesses.
I keep threatening when the prosecution says I would call the next witness to sort of stand up and very stoically and with my eyes straight ahead begin walking to the witness chair.
2 days ago, I stood up and I said that Rennie Davis had hypnotized me. Immediately dropped.
You're a co-conspirator.
Yeah, I'm an unindicted co-conspirator, and the supporting actor, best supporting actor, and along with Pegasus.
Right.
But usually in these conspiracy things, the kind of an unindicted co-conspirator is a stool pigeon, and the reason he hasn't been indicted is because he's turned state evidence, but there hasn't been none of that.
There's been, in 57 witnesses, there have been no what you'd call people.
Right, right.
For the government, and it's
No Chicagoans who say they were beaten up or anything like that. I mean, they claim like they were denying us permits because they were afraid if rioting started, citizens would fight citizens. People would fight each other.
Yeah.
They're for our safety as well as the safety of the people of Chicago. And they haven't produced a single Chicagoan, you know, who says, well, I was walking down the street and so-and-so threw a brick at me, you know. They just produced policemen who don't claim they were assaulted either, but just say they saw things going on. The juror, I think some of the jurors will pick up on that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's changed. I mean, if you had been this during the last few days, I mean, we started the defense. It's a total switch because all the defendants' witnesses are people.
Right.
And they can't conform to this rigid, dehumanized code that you have to abide by in the court, which is referred to as dignity and decorum by a judge, the judge. Well,
how is the jury reacting to them, to the people witnesses?
Well, quite favorably. I mean, I think we've actually sensed the split in the jury, and we're much more optimistic about at least reaching, say, a hung jury. But then again, we think that this judge has, in his last 4 years, he's had 24 jury trials and he's had 24 guilty verdicts, and he's a hanging judge, and his orders to the jury are going to be so restrictive that they're going to get the feeling that if they don't send
Chicago
us to jail, they're going to have to go. Like, somebody's going to have to go, because the government must be spending $2.5-3 million on this case. And
well, they'll probably send a lot of people away on contempt, if nothing else.
Oh, that's a certainty.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a certainty. In fact, we have a meeting this week with an expert in the country on contempt who wrote a book, The Power of Contempt, and we want him to start immediately beginning to read the transcript. The transcript at the end of the trial run like 37,000 pages. And he's already cited us for contempt, and of course everybody knows that Bobby Seale got
four years,
which is the highest sentence of contempt ever recorded in history of this country. I mean, we've looked up cases in which a defendant has thrown a chair at a witness, you know, and he's gotten like 2 years for contempt, and someone jumped in the jury box once and started slugging it out with the jury, and he got 2 years, which was reduced to 1 year.
That was a weatherman, actually.
Julius did it in a weird way. It's a 16 sentences of 3 months each,
right.
So, well, that's not bad. You know, before you can
Julius
experience
knows the law,
outrage,
right? He knows the law, supposedly. I mean, that's thing that he sticks.
Supposedly.
Oh, yeah, he's a cunning
some
thing.
Law, he knows.
He's
but
evolved into being a rat.
What's law? There are 2,750,000 laws, you know, in this country. So you just,
Let's get into the seal thing a little in terms of the other defendants and the jury, too.
Sure. Yeah, it's probably known in this area better than any other part of the country what exactly happened because of the underground press coverage of the trial here. But as people know, Bobby was yanked out of a jail here in San Francisco and sped across the country for 6 days and nights without his lawyer, Charlie Gary, knowing anybody in the Black Panther Party or any of his relatives, and all of a sudden he ends up in Chicago in Cook County Jail, and Bill Kunstler comes in to see him just to keep the lines of communication open, and the judge interprets that as meaning that Kunstler's now his lawyer. Well, we all wanted Charlie Gary, first of all, because of his brilliant defense of the Oakland Seven, and conspiracy is practically impossible to defend against. I mean, after reading the indictment 7 times, I still have no idea of what I'm being charged with and why I'm guilty and what the hell, what is going on. It's just pure Kafka trial. And Charlie Gary seems to know and seems to be able to put together a defense about it. Also, he has that, like, down-home kind of flavor that is expressly designed for the Mideast. I mean, for the...
Midwest.
Well, from here, it's Mideast, right?
No, they don't use that term in this country.
From this end?
Some of us do.
No. Middle America, they might say. But
oh, it's out there.
But the Mideast is with Arabs.
Middle of the empire.
Yeah.
It's the capital.
In the belly of the pig.
Right, in the belly of the pig.
Soft white underbelly.
It's a soft white underbelly.
Yeah.
So we all wanted Charlie to come in, and he was ill. And I've had like 40 arrests and maybe 20 or 30 trials, and anybody knows that they've been on trial, you can get a delay. I mean, but they're very anxious for this trial to start on time. The judge is 75; he's getting a little along in years, and he wanted this trial to put him in the history books. And the prosecutors are Democrats, trapped in a Republican administration. It's their last trial, and so they every once in a while, Foran will give his first campaign speech, you know, for Senator of Illinois, and he's going to run on a law and order ticket, and so that's why he's got a lot invested
Stevenson
in the trial.
Jr.
So they had to start on time, and even though Charlie flew in, you know, and said that he had to go in the hospital and asked for a six-week delay, they refused to allow it. So this infuriated Bobby as well it should. I mean, everybody has a right to their own lawyer, especially in a trial like this, which is obviously a railroad. So judge wouldn't allow it, forced Seal to accept the other two lawyers as his lawyer. He fired them on the opening day, and he likes them. I mean, they're good lawyers.
Right.
I mean, there aren't that many movement lawyers around the country, and they're certainly good. They, you know, they work 20, 30 hours a day on this trial. And after about 2 weeks, Bobby just said, well, I want the right to defend myself, which is a right. Everybody understands that as a right except Judge Hoffman. And what was referred to as outbursts, where Bobby would stand up when our lawyers got through cross-examining, say, I demand the right to cross-examine the witness. And the judge would order the marshals to throw him down in the chair, and the judge would make a long speech, and Bobby would call him a racist, and the judge would get infuriated. I mean, he pictures himself as the John Brown of the Midwest, you know, and 10 years ago I was instrumental in a desegregation suit. I am one of the best friends your race has in Chicago. And he's just like right out of the comic books in terms of his one-liners. I remember when they were impaneling the jury, they asked, which was done in about 35 minutes, I think.
He picked them out of a bar.
He just said, grabbed them, okay, he asked them one question. Our lawyers couldn't ask them a question, right?
Federal trial.
Nothing about, are you a cop, you know, were you on the streets of Chicago, did you watch it on TV? He says, can you be fair? So like about a third took off because he had just read the indictment like he was chopping our heads off, you know, and they even said that was why they couldn't be fair. So then he asked them, like, do you know the defense counsel, Mr. Wineglass from Newark, where they had the riots, you know, in 67? You know, Mr. Kunstler, he's from New York. He's
friend
not
of
from
rap
Chicago. Yeah, do you know Mr. Foran? Do you know Mr. Schultz, the prosecutor? So
from
a black
Chicago
man raises his hand and says, I don't know Mr. Foran, but my wife worked for him 6 years ago, and the judge leans over the bench and says, oh, was she a domestic, you know? Everybody goes, oh, I can't believe it. Next black woman, she says, what is your occupation? It was strange because every woman, he always asked, what's your husband's occupation? But the black woman, he didn't. He asked, what was her occupation? I didn't think of that till last night when I was speaking at Stanford. But she said, oh, I'm a cook. And he said, oh, are you a good cook, dearie? And she said, yes, I'm a good cook. Oh, that's fine. We need good cooks, you know. And so Bobby, you know, this was on and on. It kept going on like this. And Bobby called him a racist. Yeah. Said, I am not a racist. I was instrumental in a desegregation suit. Negro lawyers have come before me in this court, and I've always treated them with the utmost respect and dignity. And he talks just like that in this very flamboyant, you know, dramatic way. He's about 4'6", and he has a robe that's about 8'10", and he staggers in and bounces off the wall, and he does look like Magoo. And then the whole thing is that after a while, and especially with what happened to Bobby, you realize that he may be a clown, but he has the power to throw people in prison for a long time, in fact, send them to their death. And he has and with the power of contempt, he has quite a tyrannical weapon to use in the court. I shouldn't say he has this power, he has this authority. And one way that the drama in the courtroom can be pictured is in terms of a battle between authority and power, authority that we recognize as illegitimate. And we have the power because he knows that we're quite willing to, like, stand up and demand our rights on any kind of moral principle and run the risks and not conform to his kind of concept of dignity and decorum and dehumanization. We're not going to accept the rules that they lay down. Well, finally, he just couldn't shut up Bobby. And he leaned over one Wednesday afternoon, and he said, pointed to him, and he said, Defendant Bobby G. Seal, now becomes necessary to deal with you in the appropriate manner. Mr. Marshall, take that man out and deal with him as the manner as the law prescribes. And people like just sit there stunned, because it's always put in that kind of, you know, 1984 language where, like, well, what's that? What are they going to do? Castrate him or something? Or cut his tongue out?
Geld him.
You know, yeah. So we all went out, and sure enough, Bobby came back, and two marshals were carrying him in this chair, handcuffed and gagged. And within 10 minutes, when Len Wineglass had finished, all of a sudden you heard, "I demand the right to cross-examine the witness." I'm like, because that was about the heaviest 10 minutes I'd ever seen. I mean, it'd ever been. It's like the whole room is like a pressure cooker. First of all, it's air-conditioned. Very fancy paneling designed by the world's foremost architect, Mies van der Rohe, you know. And everything is very neat, you know, except for the defendants and the defendant's table. There's a tremendous contrast in just styles of interior decorating. And you're so close. It's not like you're facing huge police lines and tanks and everything. You have a tremendous sense of outrage, and all you know is it's only 8 feet. You know, and you just get that little judge and wring his goddamn neck, you know, and there's 4 feet away is a prosecutor, and he ain't too tough to handle. I mean, he's like a little Caesar there, Tiny Tom Foran, we call him. And, you know, you just, like, knock him right out. And and Bobby doesn't want you to do this. I mean, he doesn't want these kinds of outbursts. Sometimes we just couldn't hold back. I mean, people were just like, we couldn't hold back, so we had to speak out.
Say a little more to people why he didn't want him to do that. I mean, what?
Well, the judge had threatened us a number of times saying that we were bad bail risks and we were going to spend the rest of the trial in the Cook County Jail, and he knew it was inimitable to the whole defense of the trial that we come around the country speaking about it and raising the funds. I mean, the trial is tremendously expensive. It's a $300,000 trial.
Mm-hmm.
Costs us $400 a day just to read the transcript in the trial. He didn't want us to get it. As it was, all of us picked up at least 2 years in contempt. But the point I'm making is that what Huey Newton said once was quite dramatic in the courtroom, namely that the pig's technology couldn't stifle the power of the people when the spirit was there. And they took Bobby out 3 or 4 times that day and tried different kinds of gags. And they had a recess early. And that night we had visions of every university in the country, you know, trying to dream up ways in which to to gag this black man. And next day they had an even weirder contraption with vice, and people were building isolation booths in the cell, a la Adolf Eichmann type things. And there was one for 8, and then there was one for just Bobby, and there was different types they were building. And but nothing they could do could shut up Bobby. The more they piled on his head, and they tried tranquilizers at night, they were forcing needles into him. They just couldn't shut him up. And I think it was quite symbolic of what was going on in the courtroom. Finally, the judge had to give up, and he had to sever him from the case and find him guilty of contempt. And there's some justice in it, because we do feel contempt for the courtroom, and we do feel contempt for the system that's putting us on trial. So there is some justice. At least Bobby got a trial. That's better than what Fred Hampton got in Chicago. I mean, we were at his funeral the other night.
Let's, before we go into the defense specifically, let's talk about how the whole raid in Chicago and the attacks on the Panthers has related to to the defendants and that, what's been happening there, because, you know,
shootouts in the black community, shootouts in the black community in Chicago are a nightly occurrence. I mean, it's absolutely pitched battles. There's not a school in Chicago that has black students. High school that doesn't have police inside the high schools. I mean, they have curfew now for all kids in Chicago at 10:30. You're off the street or you're arrested right off. It's an absolute total police state, especially in the black communities. They had been after Fred Hampton for all year. I mean, they had him, they found him guilty of robbing an ice cream truck of something like 70 ice cream bars. It got 5 years, didn't he?
Yeah,
some ridiculous
like
thing, I don't know.
Then he got appealed on by some weird break.
Yeah.
Somebody confessed to it.
I don't know. It was just like a totally insane charge, but typical of Chicago. And I guess it was a week ago. The raid was at 5 o'clock in the morning. Although Chicago police participated, it was carried out through the direction of the state's attorney's office.
And they had their own police, don't they?
Hanrahan. Well, they have detectives, but there were Chicago police
attached to his office.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of Chicago police are marshals in the trial. They're deputized, especially for this role. So I think it was the same kind of arrangement. There were Chicago police involved. But it was carried out by Hanrahan, who has very intimate connections with John Mitchell in the Justice Department, and obviously is participating in this nationwide crackdown of the Panthers. They claimed that when they went and knocked on the door, the Panthers fired through the door, they fired into the hall, but lo and behold, there are no bullet holes on the walls and the halls, and no bullet holes through the door. And you open up the room, I was in the room, and the room is just like totally... looks like a firing squad. I mean, bullet holes all over the place. They obviously used a machine gun, blood all over the mattresses and the floors. Fred was obviously shot while sleeping in bed or just waking up. It was interesting because 2 days ago, Hanrahan, under the pressure, I mean, there are people like Hatcher, the mayor of Gary, Indiana, who termed it murder. Nine or ten congressmen have termed it murder. It was interesting that 2 days ago, Hanrahan released an exclusive report.
Right, to the Tribune. Right.
You heard about that. Right, it had the huge word exclusive and pages of this trumped-up reenactment of the murder. And they had pictures with... did you hear about the pictures? They had pictures in the halls next to the doorway of bullet holes with circles on them. Lo and behold, the Sun Times, which is a liberal newspaper... they sent a reporter up there, and a reporter found out that they were nail heads, that they were nails in the doors. And they immediately published the pictures and said they're nails. And Hanrahan said, well, I didn't say they were bullet holes. I mean, the paper drew those conclusions. We just gave out these pictures.
The photo
in any other state, he would have been forced to resign for outright total lie and trapped right in it within 2 hours. Just unbelievable. All we know is that we were at the memorial service. There were about 5,000 or 6,000 people that come in from all over the country. And it was quite a to-do. I mean, they're asking the Justice Department to investigate, and I see in the paper today...
Yeah, they're going to make a preliminary
investigation. Sort of like having Jesse James guard a bank, you know. I mean, it's not... It's,
well, the Justice Department quite possibly ordered the killing. So they'd certainly be the weirdest people to investigate it.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's done under fascism. We have trials. We're being tried under a Civil Rights Act. You know?
Yeah.
And you have trials for states of mind, and then you have murders in the middle of the night. That's the way it goes.
It's affected the black... In L.A., for example, with the raid there, the black community has, you know, had a big rally and so on. Has the same thing kind of thing happened in Chicago, that kind of unity around a particular thing that hadn't happened before with the NAACP and so on, or does that mean anything?
Yeah, but it does, but it has, let's say, a chilling effect. You know, I would say that fascism has a chilling effect. I mean, I have a bad cold from it today. It's not good for your health, It's weird in the way it's done. It's a special kind. It's 1984 fascism, where when Bobby was chained and gagged, the judge leaned over to him when he was brought in and uttered what I think is one of his most amazing statements, although there's been a number. He said, I want you to know, Defendant Bobby G. Seale and the other 7 defendants, that I am taking these measures solely to ensure a fair and impartial trial for all of you. You know, they always want a fair trial, and everything is done for our own good.
This is sort of a country of amiable fascism. Like, I always have a feeling that, like, I'll be being walked to the electric chair, and I'll meet the executioner, and he'll say, Stu, I think you're getting a bum deal.
You're funny.
I can give him a press release, and he says, I'll read this. Yeah, it looks interesting. I agree with some of it. And then you'll kind of feel okay about sitting down being executed because the guy ain't too uptight, and he's a pretty good guy, and you don't want to give him a rough time. It's his job.
People probably have heard about us bringing a cake to Bobby and some of the throwing kisses at the jury and other kinds of things. They're done with a specific intention, namely to try and humanize the court and maintain our humanness. I mean, after all, we're now in our third month. It's going to go on another 2 months. this 9-to-5 kind of rigorous job that none of us fit into our lifestyle. And the whole aim of the court is to dehumanize us and turn us into numbers. And our whole defense, really, is to make ourselves quite human to the jury. First of all, it's not a jury that you'd want your daughter to marry, you know. It's like it's from another world, from another empire.
10 of them are women.
And the concept of that we are members of a new nation, you know, trapped in an American empire, is quite apparent in the courtroom. I mean, we just look like we are yanked out of the reservation. I quite honestly and naively have that feeling. I mean, I don't know what I'm charged with. I have no idea what the evidence proves. I can't understand that case. For example, I showed a movie last week. And that big summary, you know, Dave Dillinger speaking to a crowd. And you see a crowd. It's a Technicolor movie, and everybody's sitting around like it's a bee. And he's saying, cool it, cool it, cool it, cool it. And that's it for like 30 seconds, and then the lights go on, and you look at each other, and you say, well, was that our movie or theirs? So, like, what happened, you know? Right. And, I mean, that case, I see more evidence in a case of scotch, you know? But that's the secret. The secret is to send us away without any evidence, because then people say, hey, did you see what they did to those 8 guys? They didn't do nothing. And they just send them up the river for 10 years like that. And people think twice about, you know, stepping out of line.
What's the defense trying to
do? We applauded when they finished
it. What's it getting into now? Tell us the last couple of days.
Well, our first witness was not allowed to come. He was John Sinclair, who was active in arranging the Rock Festival. And our defense, at least the Yippie side of it, is to say that, look, the city and the Democratic Party knew that we had 20 or 30 rock groups and performers lined up to come and play in Lincoln Park, that if they granted us a permit, that... there was going to be a Woodstock there. There were going to be 200,000 people, and they were just never going to allow 200,000 people, you know, demonstrating against Democratic Party at the time that it was making a decision. See, they'll allow people to come out here in Golden Gate Park, and they'll allow people to come to Washington to the monument to sing Give Peace a Chance, specifically because it reinforces, it serves to perpetuate their system. Like in Washington, the mayor of Washington, how do I... He's a Negro. He makes Whitney Young look like Lumumba. That night. He's the only mayor that's not elected. He's like the official doorman. He's like the butler of the country. Opens up the door and he says, "We want to congratulate the mobilization and the marshals, and this once again reaffirms America's commitment to free speech." I mean, it serves to reinforce the illusion of free speech. But you see, if there was a decision being made at that time, if you're marching on the Pentagon, you see, or if you're marching on the Democratic Party, they aren't going to allow 250,000 people to do that, because that kind of theater is intolerable. Oh, yeah, people just want to pick out a random day and go huddle around the penis on the Potomac, you know, and sing a little song with Peter, Paul, and Mitch. That's okay. That's groovy. You know, but not when the decisions are being made, like in Chicago. So our defense is that all these people would have come, the city knew this, so that they used the weapon of not giving us a permit as a weapon to stifle free speech. And our position is that anybody that engages in free speech is either in jail or on trial right now in the country. It's quite a difference from believing in free speech and doing it. The ones that are doing it stuck in prison are going. And that's what the trial is about. So John Sinclair, who was instrumental in arranging those rock groups, was not allowed to come. He's in prison. He has 9.5 to 10 years sentence for 2 joints of marijuana. And if he had been an informer, he would have been in the trial right off for the government. I mean, there's no question about it. But the rules change when you have a defense. I mean, it's amazing the contract change in what our lawyers can do and what the governments could do. Next witness, Spaulding, 75-year-old guy, had written a report condemning the Chicago police. Just before the convention, there had been a peace march, and the marchers were attacked brutally by the police, and that was one justification for self-defense training classes. And Spaulding said that the self-defense training classes would justify. He couldn't testify, so he was thrown off the stand. The next witness was a guy named Hunt, who works for Curtis Candy Company, a regular straight guy who had taken pictures out there. He came in and testified for us quite well. He went home to his job and was fired within an hour.
Oh, really? They fired him?
Fired. Oh, gee. Outright fired by Curtis Candy.
Did that get publicity in Chicago?
Don't eat some baby roots.
It's in a newspaper.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
So then...
What's the coverage been like here? Just a side point.
Not as good as it probably should be.
Does KPFA do it?
Yeah, we can. I call conspiracy office, yeah. And we've had reports from different people who've been inside. You know, almost every day. KSAN has done some of the same, and the underground newspaper.
Television.
Better probably than lots of other places. Plus, people have been out here. Rennie's been out here. Tom's been out here. John Freund's been out here. Abby's out here.
Jerry
so
been
on.
Out here.
We haven't talked to Jerry.
Well, FM is sort of like repressive tolerance. You know, I mean, it's.
We ought to bring repressive
this
tolerance.
This is a TV
back.
Trial.
I mean, the good old days of repressive tolerance. Remember, we used to get uptight because they were letting us do things.
Yeah.
Well,
the days
of Dr. Spock and the Justice Department are over.
Bring back permissive.
Yeah.
So,
Try to fake us out.
They have. There have been two reporters, one from St. Louis Post-Dispatch and one from Milwaukee, I think, Milwaukee Journal, who quit because they've been getting red-penciled. Their editors have a vested interest in that.
Lucas at the New York Times had a lot of trouble.
He's had a number of problems. But I see today and yesterday that he's writing much more. See, he wants to write in a poetic, theatrical kind of style.
Well, like
he got a telegram saying, just call the judge a judge, you know, don't describe him, don't talk about his mannerisms, don't try to put it in visual terms, because it is a visual trial.
Yeah.
I mean, if television were allowed to, in the courtroom, and it could be done so that it wouldn't distract anybody, there'd be insurrection in the country. People just wouldn't believe this trial. I mean, when Seal came in, there were people running in the corridors, fainting. I mean, people were bawling all over. There's nothing that words can say that can describe it. Now, the dialogue's been reprinted, and part of the dialogue in the New York Review of Books, and it's just unbelievable. But instead, you see, instead of TV, they have these guys running around doing the sketching. I mean, you probably see the sketches on TV. And it's really much more distracting. They have these guys running around with little pads. And especially once Bobby, when he was tied up, he tried to get out because the circulation in his hand was cut off. And the marshal just picked him up and threw him in the press gallery. Right, and, you know, the press sits about 8 inches behind the defendants. And then Bobby was just thrown in. And instead of, like, helping, you know, they just move out in that cool medium that they have and start sketching, you know, little things. It's like that picture of, like, remember the picture in Vietnam last year of a guy shooting a suspected NLF agent, whatever they call
like
him.
That
and a guy
photographer.
Want a Pulitzer Prize, you know. Right. I mean, the guy ought to be shot for, just participating in that cooler medium. Then we had some other good witnesses. We had an MP from Parliament, Ann Kerr.
How'd she make out?
She was fantastic. She had been maced and while she was in the police car, beaten. She said, "I still have the bruises if you want to see them." I mean, she knew exactly how to play against the prosecutor. The judge says, "How do I address a member of Parliament?" And she said, "Oh, you call me Anne." And that was like, they were all people, you know? My lord. She called him my lord. Call me Anne, my lord.
Is that what she said?
Yeah. And they just like, God, she was so beautiful. I mean, an architect student, you know, beautiful kid from Washington had come, and he had been beaten and clubbed on the Wednesday, and he tried, police told him to get up and leave, and he went to leave, and they clubbed him over the head and broke the club. And the prosecutor says, "Oh, how are we to believe this?" Kid pulls out half a club. They got it. It's a souvenir, half the police. I mean, it's all like that. I mean, and people are just, it's unbelievable. It's just sheer poetry. And, of course, Phil Oakes came in and testified and was going to sing. They let him say the words out to the song. And of course, Alan has really been the high point of the trial so far, I think, Ginsburg. Mm. I mean, it's just phenomenal. The clash in culture yesterday between the prosecutor for Ann, you know, tell us, Alan, just how long have you been a queer, you know? Not in so many words, but you did have, you said you had intimate relations with the defendants Rubin and Hoffman, you know, hinting at all these little things, you know.
Chuckle.
And our lawyers want to stand up, you see, and object. But we say, no, you know, like, that's not what it's about. We're not going to play that rule, and Alan certainly knows how to handle this, and we want to see this clash brought out. And he had him read some poems from, he said something about, there was one about Walt Whitman. He says, how long has it been since you've seen Mr. Whitman, you know, so he didn't even know who Walt Whitman was, you know. So we read the couple poems, and then our redirect was we just asked Alan to read Howl. You know, because it is really the trial of the 60s, yeah. And that's probably the poem of the 60s. And he read Howl.
He founded the 60s.
It was, we were like crying. I mean, I'll tell you, Hayden's converted. He's running around over in the halls. And the judge just like is reading it with this great, you know, Alan's reading it to the jury, you know, in one way. And then all of a sudden at one point, you know, he turns to the judge and just like screams it. And the judge goes, oh, like that, you know, like it reminded me of an old-time silent movie, you know, where you catch the villain who's just trying to foreclose on the young girl's house, you know, and he just draws back like this, you know, oh, the words have just like, it almost just threw him right off the bench, the judge. And, we have many more.
Where's it going from his defense?
Witnesses.
Yeah. What other?
One sitting right here.
Right, you're going to testify?
Well,
we don't
rightly know yet. I mean,
right.
the plan is for it's for some of the defendants to testify, but we're not going to we don't want to tip our hand.
Right. They had that thing with Stu on the defense plans and that kind of thing. That bust.
You mean when I was busted? Yeah, that was a weird bust. That was like the most insignificant, and the most frightening bust that I've ever had. Like the marshal, I was sitting in the back row, and the marshal says, "Stu, would you come out for a second?" And I should have been suspicious because the first time he ever called me Stu. And but the amiable executioner, you know, says, "Oh, sure, Bill, I'll just come right out." So you know, I get out, and he says, "There are two fellas out here who want to speak to you." So I sort of go strolling out, and there are two intelligence guys, Chicago Intelligence Police, Red Squad, and two FBI agents and two federal marshals, see. So they're arresting me because I skipped bail on a disorderly conduct charge that came about when we brought our candidate, Pigasus, into Chicago. And about seven of us, I guess, were busted, including the pig. And we pleaded guilty. See, it was settled, and we paid a fine. And Pigasus, I think, was electrocuted. He was electrocuted for threatening Spyro Agnew's life, Illinois electric chair. But so it was settled. It was a dead thing. And suddenly they're taking me to jail. You talk about 1984 for something that's been settled, you know. So what they did was it was obviously what they were up to was clear. They didn't take me to the regular place, you know, where you arrest someone, you bring them up, okay, book them, Charlie. Take the stuff out of your pocket, put it in an envelope, give you a receipt, you know, like that. You got bail? No, okay, put them in the clink. They brought me to the intelligence room, and they questioned me, asked me political questions, like, when was the revolution beginning? I said it began. Had you noticed?
Tom announced it.
Yeah.
One of his charges.
Yeah.
Undercover agent heard him say over the telephone that the revolution was starting.
And then
I immediately left the country with all his money.
Get your passport. So like, and then they asked me questions about did I believe in just wholesale murder, and I said no, selected, things like that, you know, but. They gave your whole
compelling aggression.
Yeah,
that's the phrase.
Yeah, all these old childhood psychological terms, manic depressive. So they took everything out of my pocket. And I said, "Now wait, I should tell you this. I'm with the legal defense section of the conspiracy, and some of those documents are documents that have to do with the defense. So you're not allowed to look at them. They're privileged." See, so they said, "Oh, what's privileged?" Probably being, populist Democrats and not relating to privilege. So they pick it up and they start reading it, and then they say, "Okay, come into the next room." So I say, "Well, wait. Can I at least have a receipt for my documents?" And they say, "Police are honest. Hadn't you heard?" And then I say, "Well, didn't you have a burglary ring here among the Chicago police once?" And they take me into the next room, and then 15 minutes later, I get the documents back. See. And because the reason that they separated me from the documents for 15 minutes was to photostat them.
Sure,
of
course.
They did the FJ here in Berkeley.
Yeah, there's no other reason for doing that.
They
don't
make bones about
it. You know?
Was there anything in there?
Well, there were defense documents in there, yeah. Yeah, and that of course, by the time I got out of jail, about 5 hours later, they were kind of admitting it was a mistake. And then 2 days later, when I appeared before a judge, he apologized, and that was the end of it, you know. But the point is that they had done the thing, you know, and it winds up costing us $10 because we had to put up $100 bail, and you get back $90, but there's a $10 service charge.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really frightening. Like, you get busted that way, you know, right in the middle of Mies van der Rohe's totalitarian architecture, you're prepared to believe that they got some stool pigeon in Berkeley who invented a story about you trying to kill Alioto, and you're going away to San Quentin forever, you know.
Right.
But, you know, the stool pigeons are turning up and accusing us of killing God these days. So, it's just part of a day's work for the conspiracy.
As long as they don't accuse us of killing Bishop Pike.
Right.
There's
so it's typical Chicago. I know the car that I ride around with, one policeman who was friendly, and there are a couple, you know, who luck leak out who are friendly, said that, told Ron Kaufman, the guy who was driving me around, that this car was listed as a public nuisance, and it had been busted for things like going through red lights that aren't there and all that kind of harassment. What was interesting, there are great parallels between the trial and what actually happened in Chicago when we went during the convention. For example, we had these training classes in the park because we had all kinds of rumors that there were gangs in the area of Old Town near Lincoln Park who were going to come into the park and want to vamp on people, you know. So we had these training classes. Well, of course, once the police opened up their attack the first night, that Sunday night, these gangs just kept coming in and joining us. And the same way in the court. I mean, we felt sure once this stuff would come out, we'd be the opening day. We'd be lucky if half of us survived assassination attempts by the people. And we had all the buildings checked out and stuff like that. But as soon as they saw, you know, the nature of the law and the nature of the trial and the way the judge was handling, I mean, as opening day, threw half our lawyers in jail. You know, the way that he was going about it, that we became a. We became the hometown guys.
Yeah, they
Chicago
really did.
The Chicago conspiracy is very, it's unbelievable. You walk down the street, people say good luck and give you money and, you know, go get them. We're like their local
black guys give you the salute,
team,
you know.
Yeah.
It's
so
like
well
thing,
known.
The underdogs, the
it
Mets.
It may not, you know, it's just sort of known out here in a very, abstract way,
right.
The trial.
Right.
But in Chicago, it's very personal. And Chicago's a very personal city. You know, the politics are very personal on both sides. It is, after all, the only American city. I mean, San Francisco's a cosmopolitan city. New York, it's
European.
Highfalutin politics. But in Chicago, it's nitty gritty stuff on both sides, and it's a very personal trial. And we really have the people of Chicago on our side.
Right.
We have a good conception. There are crowds. 300-400 people a day lined up at each session to try and get in.
Oh yeah, there's one more point about my bust I should bring up. That in the police intelligence room there was a blackboard with about 20 names on the blackboard, and my name was one of them. All the defendants and a lot of other people, weathermen and so forth.
Right.
And it just looked to me like a pick.
And we're in a position of putting the government on trial, in a national trial. Because of the length of the trial and because it is the only federal trial for conspiracy going, we have these contacts all around the country, and we want to use the trial to organize around political repression that's going on, and in particular what's happening to the Black Panther Party. And in local areas, when our jury goes out, it'll be in a month or 2 months, depending on what kind of evidence we're allowed to bring before the trial, like... We're having expert witnesses on Vietnam, like Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Donald Duncan, Benjamin Spock. People like this will come in and testify about that. We don't think that will be allowed, but they'll just put in an appearance. If it is, the trial will be longer. So, but anyways, everybody will know when the defense rests. And at that time, the judge will issue these instructions to the jury, and the jury will go out. And we're asking for a jury of our peers. to go out around the country and campuses, churches, and conduct discussions, teach-ins about the trial, about political repression, and consider the case against the government. The case for 10 years, we can conceptualize the whole 1960s as our generation's trial of the government, beginning with the sit-ins on February 1st, 1960. In fact, I was just... I went to graduate school here just 10 years ago.
You were down south in the Civil Rights.
So my 10th birthday comes.
You were down south during the Civil Rights thing.
Yes, but I actually got. I went to college, what you call college, in the '50s, and politics was just Eisenhower playing golf and us going to the big game down to Stanford. I mean, but there was nothing else. I mean, Pete Seeger come around once a year or so, and that was it. But my eyes were really open when I saw that sit-in February 1st, 1960 by black people. I knew two black people. One was a maid that came in on Thursdays, and the other one was president of the high school senior class, right? always president. Nobody ever knew what to do with them in the 50s, so he made them presidents of the student council. And hell, seeing something... people taking control over their own lives and taking matters into their own hands, and people of our own generation, and it was quite a shock. And I remember just about 2 or 3 days after that, about right down the street from here, the Woolworths, was the first picket I'd ever seen in my life in support of what was going on in Greensboro. And it was a month later that I had heard about Carol Chessman over at San Quentin, and this was a guy who was on death row for about 11 years, had written 10 novels. It's sort of like trashy books. I'd read a couple of them, but I always thought it was cool, a guy writing on death row, And he had been accused of raping a woman in Los Angeles, and he was now finally going to meet his maker, in the gas chamber over there. And I heard Marlon Brando was going to be out there and Shirley MacLaine, so I figured, what the hell, I'd go out, And we had these signs, and we were sort of having a vigil, And the warden came out and said, well, I agree with your goal, but not your methods, but you're nice people, well-meaning. And he gave us donuts, and he had all his henchmen bring us out donuts and coffee and blankets to keep warm. Pat Boone, Pat Boone.
Pat Boone.
Who was the governor? Pat Brown. He was next to Stevenson. I suppose Brown was the leading liberal then, and he said... I am against capital punishment, but in this case, my hands are tied. It's 10 o'clock that morning. Out come a guy and read from a parchment that, in some gobbledygook language like the type that's used in this courtroom, and lo and behold, Cal Chessman was dead. And we felt pretty impotent. Who do you blame, Here's the warden, he's an okay guy. After all, he gave us the donuts, Here's Pat Boone. His hands are tied. But he's against capital punishment. He's for us. I just heard that attitude so often. I'm in the South, and McCone was beaten up by local sheriffs and Justice Department officials watch and say, this is horrible, what's happening? They'd say that at the very instant that you're beaten up, and they're taking down notes and giving a fair report back to Washington, and they say, call us up when you're in trouble. Call us collect, In trouble, fucking... excuse me. I just got it right out there. Bleeding all over the ground. The whole attitude, reached its point at the Democratic Convention in 1968. And I guess the die is cast in the 70s. It's going to be quite... This trial is an anachronism, really. The eight of us are already feeling our way into the 70s with different attitudes, different reexamination of violence and revolutionary violence as opposed to institutional violence, and nation concepts and the need for cultural revolution and things like that. And we're trapped in a trial in an era that's behind us. It's interesting nonetheless, and we hope though at that time that people will go out and we'll have meetings and we'll consider the case and stay out as long as the jury stays out 2, 3, 4, 5 days, and then they find the government guilty, they should carry out the sentence in the streets.
Sentence the government to death.
Death, yes. Well, I know the eight of us have. I mean, the eight of us have.
What are you going to do with a government for the rest of its life if you?
Well, just people ask me, like,
license plates.
You don't like it here. How come you don't leave? And I say, I left. I mean, I already left, man. I ain't part of that nation. I was a new nation. And we had a meeting in New York trying to formulate some of the concepts of nation. Because I think it's a concept that has particular appeal to young people. We ain't part of that American empire, that dinosaur sinking in the mud.
The pig empire versus the people's nation.
It's good to come out here and come visit my home on my 10th birthday.
Right.
See old Berkeley.
Okay.
Old Berkeley.
Thanks.
Okay. See you, man. All right.